All right, guys, we're going to be in 1 Corinthians 7 today. For those of you guys who were here last week, I am terribly sorry. This is the last time I'm going to talk about sex for a while, but this chapter is about sex, too. I'm sorry. So I hope you guys don't get uncomfortable. I'm going to try to go through this very quickly, and that way, hopefully, there will be some time afterwards for you guys to ask some questions, because these are very important issues that I think we're about to go over. So if you guys have your Bibles, it's 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1. And it begins like this. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me. The thing that we have to remember about this particular book of the Bible, 1 Corinthians, is that it is a specific letter written to specific people. And Paul is an inspired author, but he's going to be dealing with specific issues that are going on in the church. And whenever he's going over something that's not for everybody, he's very clear about it. Like, he definitely points it out. And this is one of those pointers. Concerning the things which you wrote to me. We have no idea what the Corinthians wrote to Paul. Based on the stuff that they were doing, I could only imagine how jacked up that letter was. Because as Tom was going over last time, they were not only suing each other, but they were having sex with temple prostitutes and thinking that was cool. So I have no idea what kind of letter they wrote Paul. But his response to the letter is pretty severe, which lets me know that they probably wrote something that was very wrong. They were asking him some questions that revealed a lot of spiritual immaturity. All right, and this becomes important. This is an aside. We'll definitely get there when we get to 1 Corinthians 11. Because when we get to 1 Corinthians 11, Paul's going to go over a practice of headdress wearing. And he says that women have to wear headdresses or else they can't speak in church. And a lot of people look at that, they're like, well, that's pretty hardcore. Why don't any of the churches follow it? Well, because right after he says that, he says, no other church has this custom but you. So Paul, whenever he's giving specific information to the church at Corinth, he is always free and he always gives them a heads up. This is specific just to Corinth. And this is an aside, but if you guys ever wonder, like, why do we have certain practices in the church? The foundation for the practices that we have at this church, the reason why we do certain things like communion, prayers for healing, the requirements that we have is it has to be mentioned in the Gospels, practiced in the book of Acts, and then mentioned in the, and if it, it could be also mentioned in the epistles. So if you wonder, like, why do we take communion? Well, Jesus instituted it in the Gospels. It's practiced in the book of Acts, and it's also mentioned in the books that we mention here. But if you ask the question, like, well, why don't we practice baptism for the dead, which is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15? It's only briefly mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15. It doesn't tell us how to do it. And it's never mentioned by Jesus, and it's never practiced by the early church. So that's why we don't do it. So that becomes our standard. I know that was kind of weird, and a lot of you don't care. But I just felt like I had to say that. So concerning the stuff that they wrote to him, it's still verse 1, actually. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. So this is why it's so important that we recognize verse 1, because verse 2 sounds weird. It makes it sound like married guys are wrong. Because Paul says, concerning the things that you wrote to me, it's good for a man never to touch a woman. And then he says, but nevertheless, to abstain from sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. And because a lot of people don't understand verse 1, they draw wrong conclusions from verse 2. And what they say is like, well, okay, I'm a guy, and I struggle with sexual immorality. I struggle with pornography. I struggle with having sex with multiple girls. So how do I fix it? I get married. I get married, and that solves all my problems, because then I have a woman that has to have sex with me. And they read 1 Corinthians 7, and it totally ruins their marriage. And then they also quote this next part, which just makes me laugh, almost out of sadness. Verse 3, let the husband render to his wife the affection due to her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. So these people who believe, like, okay, the way to deal with my sexual morality is to get married, they then take this next verse, and when they are struggling with sexual morality and they feel that their spouse is not giving them sex as often as they feel they need it, they'll bring up this verse and say, your body is mine, which I know that you ladies are just dying to hear when you get married. And then you want to hear that your husband say that to you. Your body is mine. You need to render to me the affection that is due to me. That's what 1 Corinthians 7 talks about. But we have to remember this is regarding the things that the Corinthian church wrote to Paul. Now, what did they write to him? We don't know. But there are some theories as to what they wrote to him and why Paul would respond in this way. One of the theories that I tend to agree with a little bit more is that they wrote to him concerning the idea of, is it okay for me to have a wife but to still have extramarital sex? That could be a possibility because in Greek culture that was very common. In fact, even today, if you go into a lot of cultures that have arranged marriages, it's not weird for them to have a wife, to have kids with that wife, but to have sex with multiple different partners outside their marriage. It's not a weird thing to do because they say, my wife is for children and family, other women, and even sometimes men are for pleasure. And that's what they'll say in those kind of situations. So it is very likely that that is what they wrote to Paul. Hey, man, I have a wife, but is it cool for me to still have sex at the temple of Aphrodite? Is that still cool? And Paul says, no, and that kind of makes sense in the context, right? It's good for you to not touch a woman. But nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let you have intercourse, let you have intimacy with your wife and not with these other women. Now, another theory is that it could be referring to the idea of what the Gnostics believed, and it's a lot what certain Christians today kind of believe. Sex is icky, and so you're more righteous if you don't have sex. So even to this day, you'll hear a lot of Catholic families especially who will say, well, sex is just for procreation. It's not to enjoy. You just kind of get in there, you close your eyes, you do your thing, and then you get out of there as fast as you can, and then maybe you'll have kids. And that's kind of their view of it. And I'll have students online who have not had intimacy with their spouse for 20 years. You know, they barely have intimacy at all. And it'll be like, whoa, that's like grieving to me. And so Paul could also be referring to that, referring to the idea of like, no, it's not good for you guys to be married and not having intimacy with one another. God created intimacy to be between a man and a woman. It's supposed to be enjoyed. It is not to be refrained from. All right, so those are the two possibilities. What he is definitely not saying, that if you struggle with sexual immorality, the solution is to get married. If you do that, I guarantee you, you will have a failed marriage. I can absolutely guarantee you of that. You will have a completely failed marriage. And I mean, think about how jacked up that is if I looked at it that way. I'm like, well, I struggle with pornography, so why don't I just get married? And then I look at Emma and she's like, why do you want to marry me? I'm like, well, because I struggle with porn, so you're going to be my substitute porn. Does that really work? Is that beneficial for her or for me? No, now I'm just using her for myself, and that doesn't sound like God's love to me. That sounds like borderline prostitution. All right, so clearly that's not what Paul is getting at. And that also means that verse 3, when it says, let a husband render to his wife the affection due to her, and likewise the wife to her husband, when he uses the word affection, he's not just talking about sex. He's talking about the idea of general affection within the marriage. That it's not good for a husband and a wife to be blatantly cold to one another and to practice some of the stuff that I'm certain that you guys have seen in your own life with bad marriages, where you'll see two people after a while and they're basically just roommates. Basically. You know, they kind of just hang together because they're like, well, divorce would be kind of lame at this point. You know, I'm not going to find anyone else, so I'm just going to stick it out to the bitter end. And that's kind of their mentality towards it. So Paul's saying that's not right either. That's not right either. There's certain affections that your wife is due. There's certain affections that your husband is due when you get married. To care for one another, to love one another, to be intimate with one another, not just sexually, but intimate in other ways. Of talking to one another and enjoying one another in certain things. So that's what Paul's getting at. There's certain affections that are due to the husband and wife. Don't deny each other that. That's a sinful thing to do, to deny each other those types of affections. And then verse 4, where it says, the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. There's a great, a way to understand verses like this. And I like the way that one pastor puts it. He says, don't read other people's mail. Meaning, when Paul gives a commandment to women. It's not the husband's job to hold them accountable to that. Does that make sense? So if Paul gives a commandment to the wife, it's not my job as a husband to hold her accountable. You need to submit to me because it says in Ephesians 5. That's between her and God. I am to listen to the part that's given to me. I am not to give that to my wife. And the wife is not to give that to the husband. That's between him and God, and that's between her and God. You're not to enforce it on each other, because then you're going to have a very abusive relationship, a very verbally abusive relationship if you do that. And it's not going to work either. All right, so when I read verse 4, me as a man who's about to be married, I should read it, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. I should never read it, my wife doesn't have authority over her own body, I do. I should always read it, I don't have authority over my body, she has authority over my body. This is a verse of submission for me that I need to listen to. And I will say this as well, because it's important. This verse is true for me today. It's not just true for me when I get married one day. It is true for me today. My body is not my own. It is Emma's. And there's ways that I use my body to serve her. And right now, the best way for me to serve Emma sexually with my body is to not have sex with her. That is how my body serves her, is to not have sex with her. Because I understand something. If I were to have intimacy with her right now, it would bring upon her a lot of guilt, shame, condemnation, and separation from God. That's what the Bible says. Sexual immorality separates you from God. It's a sin against your own body. So for me to do that would actually be to harm her. Now this is really important for you girls to listen to. If a guy says, if you love me, we should have sex right now, before marriage, is that a loving thing for him to say? Because is it going to benefit you, or is it going to harm you if you say yes to that? It's going to harm you. It's going to hurt your relationship with God. So if me as a man, if I tell someone, I love you, Emma, so we should have intimacy right now, I'm not acting in love. I'm acting in selfishness. I don't love her. I just want to use her right now. If I really love her, says in 1 Corinthians 13, verse 4, love suffers long and is kind. If I really loved her, I'd be exercising patience. I'd be exercising patience and not selfishness. And just so you guys know, the married guys will attest to that. There will be a lot of times when you're married where you can't have sex. And if you don't learn to exercise patience now, you're going to blow it when you get married. There's going to be times where your spouse is sick. There's going to be times where your spouse isn't there. And if you don't learn to control yourself now, which is one of the fruits of the Spirit, if you don't learn how to control yourself now, when you get married, you're going to totally tank that marriage. Well, I don't care if you're sick. I want to have sex. I don't care how you're feeling. I want to have sex. You don't want me to fall into sexual immorality, do you? Your body is mine, and you'll ruin the relationship. You will absolutely ruin the relationship. I can guarantee you of that. And surprisingly, this happens every single day. Every single day. Those of you guys who don't know, me and Bo and Mike, we run a purity group on Tuesdays. And these are guys who come in, and they're not like what you'd expect for people who are addicted to pornography. You kind of expect the nerdy dude who's never had a girl. The majority of people in our group are married. The vast majority of people in our group are married. I would say how many people do we have last week? Almost 20. Almost 20 in the church that are coming to this group who are married and are addicted to pornography. All right, and that's something for you single guys to really listen to. Marriage is not the solution to your lust problem. It will continue. And these are guys who, if you look at them, they're people who just go to church. They're good-looking guys. They're successful. They have jobs. They can act the right part, they can speak in the right language to people, and you listen to them and be like, man, these guys sound like they're right on Christian men. But in their relationship with their spouse, they are, and I would call it, abusive. Not that they hit their wife, or they're verbally assaultive to their wife, but the way that they treat their sexuality with their spouse, I would say, is flat out abusive. They treat their wife like pornography. And it's not loving in the slightest. And it's a vicious cycle. Because the husband treats the wife like junk in intimacy, and then the wife doesn't want to be in intimacy with the husband. It's a very vicious cycle. And so he goes and views more porn, and she gets mad, and she's hurt, and then he wants to have more sex with her to fix his porn problem, and it just goes around and around and around, and it tanks. It just completely annihilates the marriage. Completely annihilates it. And that's another important thing to understand about this verse. Like I said, it's not the things that Paul's about to say to us, it's not for everybody, but I'm saying that there are things that we can definitely pull out that are for everybody. And the number one thing that I need to pull out from this verse is something that I didn't understand until I was 22 years old. There is a proper way to have intimacy when you are married. There is a proper way to have intimacy when you get married, which is something that I didn't understand when I was your age. When I was your age, I just thought, well, it's just wrong to have sex before marriage. That's the only thing that's wrong, is to have sex before marriage. So as long as I don't do that and I get married, I can do whatever I want when I get married. That's the way I thought. Now be honest. How many of you guys have really thought about the idea of there is a proper way to use my sexuality when I get married? Yeah, so you're like me. You know, you didn't really think that way. I definitely didn't think that way. And that's why it shocked me. It shocked me when I first started coming to the groups here and I started seeing these married men who were struggling, who were failing as husbands, who were failing as fathers because they didn't deal with this. They didn't deal with this area of their life. They did not deal with their sexuality. And there are a lot of women who never deal with their sexuality. And so it hurts the marriage. It disturbs the marriage. Okay, and it's very important because a lot of wives, and this is sad to say, very sad to say, a lot of wives think the way I honor God in my marriage is just doing what my husband says, whether I enjoy it or not. It means that if my husband wants to have sex with me, the way that I honor God is to just have sex with him, whether I want to or not. And you know what that breeds? A whole lot of bitterness. A whole lot of bitterness. Because once again, it's not going to take long for you girls to realize he doesn't love me, he just uses me. And it's going to make you hate your spouse. There are ways for us to submit as married people. There are ways for me to submit to my spouse that doesn't just mean, well, I lay down and I take it. It's not what's being referred to here. And he goes on. Let me explain it to you in the next verses. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourself to fasting and to prayer and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. And we'll get into verse 7 in a second. That's for all you single people. But we're going to stay on married people for a second here. All right, so he's saying this idea of don't deprive one another except for a time, but notice what you're supposed to be doing with the time that you're not intimate with one another. You're supposed to be fasting and praying. You're supposed to be intimate with God. You're supposed to be intimate with God. If you guys have your Bibles, I want you guys to flip in them to Colossians chapter 2. And I want you guys to flip there. It's a very short verse, but I want you guys to, if you're single especially, underline it. Remember this one, because it's going to be very important for you. Colossians 2, verse 10. You are complete in Him, who is the head of all principality and power. You are complete in Jesus, who is the head of all principality and power. I know that you guys, this movie probably predates you. I'm sure you guys have never seen it. Have you guys seen Jerry Maguire? Yeah, one of you, maybe a couple of you. Okay, there's a line in that movie that is repeated through Hollywood ever since that movie came out, and it is, "You complete me." You guys ever heard that? Where he looks at the girl he loves and he says, "You complete me." And Hollywood's like, "Oh, how loving. He was incomplete before he knew her. That's so beautiful. There was a hole in his heart and she fills it. Man, that is gorgeous." But when you really stop and think about it, is it really loving to say that? You complete me. If I looked at Emma, hey, you complete me. What happens when she's having a bad day? What happens when she's struggling? What happens when she's pregnant? What happens when she's not completing me? If I go into the relationship incomplete, needing something from her, I will be selfish, and all I'm going to do in that relationship is take. I will never, ever give. See, God has a unique ability to love in a way that is only giving. He only gives because God's complete. And it's only until I become complete in Jesus that I can love people that way. If I don't, then all I'm going to do is take. And it's evidenced by even, have you guys ever heard of, what's it called? Love and Respect. You guys ever heard of Love and Respect? You ever heard of that marriage thing? It's a great program. I do love it. But here's the problem. People who are incomplete going into Love and Respect, and just so you guys know who've never heard of it, what he basically goes over is Ephesians 5, where it says, wives submit to your husbands as Christ also, as we submit to Christ. Husbands love your wives as Christ also loved the church. So we go into that and he'll say, like, okay, so see, the primary role and responsibility of a wife is to submit and give honor to her husband, and the primary role of the husband is to love and support his wife. Now here's the problem. If someone incomplete goes into that though, all they're going to hear is, I give my wife love, she gives me respect. It's a trade-off. Okay, I'm not serving, I'm not giving because I want to, I'm giving to receive. Right? It's kind of like Christmas. Why do I buy presents for other people? Because they're going to buy presents for me, right? It's a very selfish thing. It's not a selfless act. It's not an act where it's just like, man, I just like buying presents for you. It's a completely selfish act. I give in order to receive. If you are incomplete going into a relationship, the best you are going to do is you will serve with the intent of being served right back. You will not be able to selflessly serve. I serve my wife because I love God and I am complete in Him, and this is how I serve God. If you don't understand that, like I said, you are always going to be selfish. And here's a really great way for you to understand that. Have you ever, I'm sure you guys have, or you've struggled with this before in your own life. Okay, have you ever seen someone who, when someone else is suffering, they just make it worse and they make it all about them? Like somebody's crying, they're like, oh man, you know, my life is terrible. And then they go and they talk to that person and then they start crying and they're like, oh, I'm so sad that you're sad. And they get sad about themselves. And you see them later, you're like, why are you so sad? Oh, because this person's suffering and it's affecting me and my life. And it's a very selfish way to act. All right, so instead of actually supporting that person and helping them, all they did is they made their pain all about themselves. You guys ever known someone who does something like that? Okay, that comes from a lot of selfishness. That comes from a lot of incompleteness. I need attention to justify my actions. It comes from someone who does not understand Colossians 2 verse 10. Okay, but to understand Colossians 2 verse 10 will give you the ability to comfort those who mourn, to actually support and help people who are hurting without expecting anything in return. Because your joy comes from giving, not receiving. And this is going to get a little intimate for you guys, and I hope you can just bear with me. Don't freak out, okay? God's love, Jesus' love, finds more joy in giving than receiving. Hebrews 12, verse 2 says, for the joy set out before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. Jesus' love finds more joy in giving than receiving. All right, now just keep that in mind. In intimacy, Jesus' love finds more joy in giving than receiving. Okay, think about that. Jesus' love finds more joy in giving than receiving. So when I'm intimate with my spouse, I should be thinking more about her betterment and not my own orgasm. Okay, that's what godly intimacy is about. It's about lovingly giving, not expecting to receive. And Paul is dealing with a church who does not understand that. And that's why I believe he emphasizes for the majority of this chapter, just stay single. Just please stay single. You know, please, for the love of God, stay single. And that's why I think he's emphasizing it so much, because he understands they don't get that. And so if they get married, they will ruin it. And I guarantee you guys, if you get married and you don't understand this, you will ruin it. You will ruin it. At best, again, you're going to make it till death, but it's not going to be fun. It's definitely not going to be an enjoyable marriage. All right, and so that being said, when we talk about the idea of, I'm going to use a word here, self-gratification, which is masturbation. Okay, when we use the term self-gratification, when we use the term pornography, is that in line with Jesus' love to view pornography and to self-gratify? Is anybody being benefited by that but me? No. I'm using other people to gratify self at the expense of them. I'm being selfish. So whenever I hear the question from guys, usually, sometimes girls, but more than often it's guys, of, is it really a sin to self-gratify? And I would say, yeah, it is. Is it really a sin to masturbate? Yeah, it is. Reason? Because you're being selfish. It's all about you. And if you think that when you get married, you could just flip a switch and, oh, it's all going to be about my spouse now, you're wrong. Every single time you self-gratify, it's ingraining in your soul, sex is all about me. And you will drag that into your marriage, guaranteed. You're going to ruin it. That's why in Hebrews 12 it says, keep the marriage bed undefiled. There's a way to defile the marriage bed. And it's not just bringing another person into it. There are other ways to defile the marriage bed. And I want you guys to know that. I want you guys to know that, because if you don't know that, I would hate for you guys to get married in however many years, hopefully for a lot of you, like 10 years. I would hate for you guys to get married in like 10 years. You a little earlier, hopefully. But you're one of the older ones. I would hate for you guys to get married in a couple years and for your marriage to fall apart. For you to do premarital counseling here and then just a couple years later do postmarital counseling here. I have men who've only been married for 6 months and their wife's already talking about divorce. It happens all the time. It happens all the stinking time. And I don't want it to happen to you guys. And that's why I'm being so honest and frank with you guys in this sermon. And that's why I said, after this is over, I'm going to give you guys a chance to ask me questions, because I don't want you to leave here confused about any of this stuff. All right, but let's talk about singleness real quick, because it's cool. All right, so in verse 6, he says, but I say this as a concession, not as a commandment, for I wish that all men were even as I myself. Paul was single. Paul was a single guy. He never got married. But each one his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. So Paul, he's saying something. He's saying it's better for you guys to be single than to be married. This is the only church that Paul says this to, just so you guys know. He doesn't say it to the church of Ephesus, doesn't say it to the church of Colossus, doesn't say it in Peter's epistles, he never mentions it. In James' epistle, he never mentions it. This is the only book where anyone says it's better for you to remain single than to marry. Only book. So that tells me that more than likely, Paul is referencing something specific that's happening in the church. And he gets more clear about that in verse 26. I suppose, therefore, that it is good because of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. If you are bound to a wife, then don't seek to be loose. If you're loose from a wife, don't seek to have a wife. So he could be referring to some sort of persecution that was happening at the church, and I think there definitely was. We do know the Jews were persecuting the church at this time. But he could also be referring to their immaturity. It's good because of the present distress. It's good because of your guys' immaturity just to remain single. Don't seek to be married. He could be referencing that as well. So he's going to harp on singleness. And he calls it a gift. He calls it a gift. He says singleness is a gift. It's a beautiful thing. It's an awesome thing. Marriage is also a gift, but it's a different gift. You can't have both gifts at the same time, which is logical, right? You can't be a married single guy. You got it. You got one or the other. God's going to give you one gift or the other. So if you're single right now, there's a gift for you. If you're married right now, well, none of you are. Except for Mike and Tom. But if you guys are going to be married, there's another gift for you guys in marriage. Okay, and I'm going to tell you guys the gift in marriage very quickly. Marriage will help you understand the nature of God and His intimacy with His people better. Right? Sex in 1 Corinthians 6 is mentioned as being a picture of how Christ is intimate with His church. Not that Christ has sex with us. I don't want you guys to hear that. Not that He has sex with us, but the fact that He's spiritually one with you now, if you are a child of His, you are spiritually one with God, is what it says. Sex is to help you better understand that. And not just sex, but the marriage relationship as a whole. We are called the bride of Christ. Song of Solomon, which is all about sex, by the way, we have a whole book in the Bible dedicated to sex, so it must be kind of important. Song of Solomon, which is all about sex, is understood by most theologians to be a picture of God and His people. All right, so marriage will help you understand the nature, passion, intimacy, and love that God shares with His people better. That's the gift that's in marriage. It is supposed to be an acted out sermon. Okay? If I look at Mike and Ashley, I should look at, hey, the way that Mike loves Ashley, that's the way that Jesus loves me. The way that Ashley submits to Mike, that's how I should submit to God. Their marriage is supposed to be a walking, talking sermon all the time. That's the purpose of marriage, is to help you understand the nature of God and the intimacy He has with His church, and for people around you to understand that as well. That's what marriage, that's the gift that's in marriage. It's kind of cool when you think about it. Now, the gift of singleness is another gift. So for you guys who are single, there's a gift. All right, and you may be asking yourself, well, probably not, but you guys might, down the road, ask yourself, well, okay, if married people experience the intimacy of God through marriage, how do I as a single person understand the intimacy of God? Very simple. You understand the intimacy of God by learning to fall in love with God's church. Learning to serve and love others is how you experience the love and intimacy that God has. If you read some of the epistles of Paul, I'm not going to get into them right now. If you read Philippians, if you read 1 and 2 Thessalonians, Paul uses very intimate language when he's talking to the church. He says, I think about you all the time. I'm praying for you morning and night. I love you guys. You say, man, you guys are my joy and my crown. You're my hope. Man, I can't wait to see you. I long for your face. He says very intimate language like that over and over again in those books. And when you read that, if you took out the pronouns, you would swear that Paul's talking to somebody he loves. You would swear that he's talking to his wife. But he's not. He's talking to the church. Paul learned how to fall in love with the body of Christ. That's how he understood and experienced the intimacy that is between God and His church. So for those of you guys who are single, that's how you do it. And the convicting question is, for you single guys and girls, how are you doing with that? Are you learning to love the body of God? If you're not, you're wasting your singleness. You're wasting the gift that God has given you in your singleness. Learning to love the body of Christ, learning to serve God more in your singleness than you could if you were married, is the purpose of singleness. And we'll talk about that more and more as we go through this chapter. If you're not doing that, you are wasting your singleness. Doesn't mean that there's some severe judgment for you. Doesn't mean that I'm telling you guys you suck. I'm just saying that if you are in this spot of singleness and you're not learning how to do these things, you're wasting it. You need to learn how to do it. You need to learn how to love the body of Christ. You need to learn how to serve God more and more every day, or else you're going to waste it. You're going to waste it. For a long time, I wasted my singleness. All the time when I was single, all I could think about was getting out of my singleness. You know, I was just like always planning on how to get out of my singleness because I hated it. I was like, man, I'm like 22 years old. I'm just out of the Marine Corps. Why am I not married yet? You know, and I was really angry because all my friends were married. And now all of them are divorced. But, you know, like all of them are married. I'm like, man, I want to get out of my singleness. You know, and I was always thinking that way of how do I do that? And all my friends that were girls, I was always thinking like, maybe I'll date her. Maybe I'll date her. And I was just being kind of a scumbag, you know, and because I didn't understand the gift that I had in God and I didn't use it. It was only for the last 6 months that I was single that I finally used the gift of God in my singleness. And I'm thankful for those 6 months. But when God finally started to call me out of my singleness, I kind of freaked out and I held on to it and I tried to hate Emma, which you can ask her about if you want. But like I did a lot of stupid things when God called me out of my singleness. So I encourage you guys, learn to use your singleness now. Learn to enjoy it now. Because it is a wonderful gift. And if God calls you out of it, then right on. That's why He says, if you cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. So meaning it's not wrong to marry, and it's not wrong to burn with passion to be married. But if you're content with your singleness, stay single. If you burn with passion, if you really want to get married, it's not wrong for you to want to get married either. but to live as you are called is what Paul's getting at. Now, in verse 10, I'm going to go over this very quickly because it doesn't really apply to you guys. Now, to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or to be reconciled to her husband, and the husband is not to divorce his wife. But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under the bondage in such cases. But God has called us to be at peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether or not you will save your husband? And how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? So he goes over this idea of, what if you're married to someone who doesn't believe? What if you're married to someone who doesn't believe? Is it okay to divorce in that case? And Paul says, no, it's not. He says it's better for you to love that wife or husband and to share the gospel with them, and hopefully they'll come to believe in the Lord. But he says, but if the unbelieving spouse leaves, let him leave. It's not your obligation as the Christian to make sure that they stay. Now, obviously, the ideal is that you guys don't have to follow this because you don't marry a non-believer. That's the ideal. Don't marry a non-believer, and then you don't even have to worry about this section. But if you marry a non-believer, you're going to worry about this section. Because I guarantee you, it's not going to be long before your marriage suffers because you don't share the same ideals or values. Because once again, you're going to be on fire for the Lord. You're going to be like, man, I want to serve the Lord. And your spouse, who is an atheist or something else, is like, I don't really care about the Lord. I don't give a crap. And you're going to have kids. You'll be like, I want our kids to go to church. And he's like, I don't want to fill their heads with fairy tales. And then you're going to get into disputes about these things. This is a central issue of your life. If you believe in an eternity with God and someone else does not, that's going to lead to a lot of problems. Many, 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 many problems. Also, someone who is unbeliever, I went over this last time, they don't have the same values and regulations that you do. Let's put it that way. It means this. If, you know, I do struggle with pornography. I haven't viewed it in a very long time, but I do struggle with lust and pornography. And I'm very thankful for the victory that God has been giving me. But what if I wasn't a believer and I'm married to Emma and she found out that I view pornography on a regular basis? And she says to me, well, I don't really like it when you do that. It hurts me a lot. I don't appreciate it. It takes away my value. I feel very insecure when you do those things. And I say to her, well, I don't really see anything wrong with it. She says, well, in the Bible it says that you shouldn't. Well, I don't believe in the Bible, so whatever. In fact, I could pull out tons of psychological reports that actually say that pornography is healthy for marriage. You see how that could be a problem? I can now quote psychologists and different people and show my wife, well, no, you see that pornography is actually healthy to grow a marriage. And you should be viewing porn too. And we should view it together. You see how that could hurt our marriage? If you don't have the same standard of morals as your spouse, it will lead to huge problems. But thank God that if I were to view pornography, Emma now has a standard to hold me to. She has something to hold me to that I have to listen to, that I have to submit to. But if I don't, then it's going to lead to major problems. So my encouragement, don't marry a non-believer. It's going to lead to huge problems in your life. Verse 17, but as God has distributed each one, as the Lord called each one, so let them walk. And so I ordain in all the churches, was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not become circumcised. Obviously, you can't become uncircumcised. Those of you guys who, it's a permanent thing. You can't, you get circumcised, you're circumcised forever. What Paul is referring to is the fact of, if you're called while Jewish, if you're called in the culture of a Jew, don't just leave the culture of the Jew and start acting like a Gentile, which doesn't mean a whole lot to you guys right now. But here's the practical application for you guys in the here and now. Becoming a Christian doesn't mean you have to leave your culture, okay, as a person. If you grow up in a Hispanic culture, it doesn't mean you have to leave the Hispanic culture and all of a sudden act like a white person. You know, that's not what it means. You can continue to be a Christian in whatever culture that you're called in. As long as your culture doesn't require you to do something that's blatantly sinful, then you go against that. So if you guys are like, you know, if you look at the church, There should be a variety of people in the church. You go into some churches, there really isn't. Everybody is white, wearing a suit and tie. And it's really odd to go into church like that. And you kind of feel awkward when you show up in jeans. But like, the church should be variety. There should be a lot of variety in the church. There should be people who like sports. There should be people who don't like sports. There should be Democrats. There should be Republicans. There should be all different walks, all different types of people, all abiding and calling on the name of Christ. You don't have to give up your political or cultural identity to become a Christian. That's a practical application for you guys. You don't have to be conformed to a particular image to be a Christian. As long as you call in the name of Christ, believe in Him, and trust Him, everything will be fine. Then we are brothers and sisters in Christ. Okay? Obviously, the belief in Christ may change certain parts of your cultural beliefs or political beliefs, and it should. You know, it should affect your stance on gay marriage. It should affect your stance on abortion, things like that. It should definitely affect your stances on those things. But it doesn't mean that you have to completely change who you are as a person fundamentally in order to be a Christian. You know, you just become like Christ. That's it. So he says in verse 19, circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Paul here is harping on the idea of people thinking like, well, I'm not too great of a Christian, so let me do this religious activity that proves that I'm a Christian. God in the Old Testament constantly harps on his people for doing this. And the church today does this, where we think it's more important to be religious on the outside than to actually do the right thing. In the book of James, he says, pure and undefiled religion is to serve the widow and the orphan. Okay, how many people in the church actually serve widows and orphans? They actually go out of their way to help people who don't have anything. Yet how many of those same people, if I were to say a cuss word in front of them, would freak out on me? You see how their religion has become more important than the commandments of God? Now, there are verses I could point out that would be like, okay, it is kind of wrong to swear, whatever. But the point is that the Bible brings up serving orphans and widows way more than it brings up inappropriate language. People's religion takes the place of what God actually intends to be important. All right, or they think that going to church on Sunday is somehow going to be beneficial for their soul, but they sin all through the week, they do the wrong thing all through the week, but on Sunday they fix their, you know, their halos and they come in, they look all holy. You know, especially if you're a son or daughter of people like that, you know the hypocrisy. You're like, oh man, like you're gonna act like this in church. But then when we go home, you act completely different. And it kind of gets to you. It's a hypocritical kind of a thing. God says, I want you to be holy. I want you to be set apart all the time. I don't want your religion. I want a relationship with you. So Paul mentions that. Don't think that circumcision is anything. Let each one remain in the same calling which he was called. Were you called like a slave? Were any of you guys called as a slave? No? Okay, that's probably not for us then. No, you know, like in Paul's culture, slavery was not a racist thing. Like when we think about slavery, a lot of people, a lot of your history teachers, sociology teachers, they may bring up this verse and be like, the New Testament supported slavery. Well, slavery in Paul's day was way different than it was in our culture. It had nothing to do with race. It had nothing to do with the subjugation and the kidnapping of hundreds of thousands of people from a different country and treating them like animals. That's not what slavery was in Paul's day. Slavery was a financial thing. If you got into too much debt, then you became a slave to work off your debt. That's what slavery was in Paul's day. There's really not a whole lot of correlations that we could pull from our culture. Maybe like if you're in credit card debt, technically you're a slave because you're not really making money. You're having to pay off that credit card. You know, like you're working for nothing is the point there. So he says, if you were called while a slave, do not be concerned about it. But if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called is the Lord, and the Lord, while a slave, is the Lord's free man. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men, brethren. Let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. So Paul here, he goes over the idea. Some people were thinking like, well, when I got into debt, I wasn't a believer. So now I'm a believer, so I could just welch on my debt. Because I'm a new creation. Becoming a Christian doesn't mean that. You know, becoming a Christian doesn't mean like, oh, I don't have to pay off my debts. I don't have to do the things that I was doing. I mean, I'm assuming that none of you are like this. But I mean, if one of you came to me and were like, well, before I became a Christian, I was a gambler or something like that, you know, and I got into a huge amount of debt while I was a gambler. But then I came to Christ and I recognized the folly of my ways and I repented and I don't do that anymore. So should I have to pay back the casino? Be like, yeah, you do. You do. It doesn't honor God to welch on your deals. It doesn't honor God to welch on your deals. And I will say that to you guys as well. There are more than one ways to honor God with your finances. Honoring God with your finances doesn't always mean giving an offering at church. Honoring God with your finances could also mean just not being in debt, not spending like an idiot, not getting into massive amounts of credit card debt, and being very, very bad stewards with what God has given you. That's a way to honor God. All right, and honestly, if one of you guys came to me and you were under a tremendous amount of debt, and you're like, man, I have this huge bill that I have to pay every single month, and I don't know if I give tithes, I'd be like, God would rather you pay your debt than to get a little bit of money for you from you in the church. Okay, the people that you owe are non-believers, more than likely, and it's a really, really bad witness for you to welch on your deal with them and to be in debt and to get more and more in debt. It's better for you to just pay off your debt than to give your religious service to God. Okay, he doesn't need your money. God's not poor. He's not broke. He's not panhandling on the street. You know, God is more than capable of taking care of his works. So God would like, again, this whole idea, if he doesn't want your religious service, he wants you to actually serve him and love him. Now, I'm not going to read this whole thing because it's basically what we were just talking about. He's going to go over more and more the idea of being unmarried, being a single person is a gift, and how you can use it to serve the body. And in verse 32, he says, "But I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife." There's a difference between a man, a wife, and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy in both body and spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. There's something that happens to you when you get married. When I was single, I could work here 60 hours a week. I could be here all night. I could do many. I was involved in a lot of different ministries. I was doing a lot of things. But now that I'm in a relationship that's leading towards marriage, I can't do those things anymore. Because my primary ministry is to my soon-to-be wife. There are many people who could stand up and give you guys a Bible study right now. But I am the only one that God has called to be a fiancé to my fiancé right now. I'm the only one who could do that. So it is important. What Paul's getting at is the idea is not that it's a bad thing. Remember, there's a certain gift for married people that they have. But he's saying, here's the benefit for single people. You don't have to worry about your spouse. You don't have to worry about supporting your family. You could do weird things as a single person. You could go on mission trips. I can't really go on a mission trip right now. If I went on a 12-month mission trip and left my wife here, that would be a problem for our marriage. It would probably cause a lot of stress and anxiety. But as a single person, you could do that. You can just drop everything and go. See, there's a lot of benefits for being single in the work of the ministry. It really is. So once again, enjoy these things while you can. But again, being married is also a wonderful, wonderful gift. It's just a different gift. I just have a different gift than people who are single. Now, he goes on and he talks about fathers with their daughters, which is kind of weird. He talks about fathers with their daughters, and he's like, basically he's talking about fathers like, hey, it would be better if you raised your daughter to just want to be single. But if she does get married, don't worry about it. And then later he says, like, if a wife is bound by the law as long as her husband lives, but if the husband dies, then she's at liberty to marry. So there's a little part there. If you notice the divorce rule, if you divorce your spouse, you should stay single, was Paul's advice. He says, if you divorce, you should stay single and seek reconciliation. Okay, there are times when reconciliation just won't happen, and through a lot of prayer and leading of the Spirit, you might be led to another marriage, for sure. Remarrying is not a sin. But as a widow, it's not even a question. Of course you could remarry if you're a widow. So yeah, and that leads to a whole different topic about the idea of divorce and separation. When the majority of people get divorced today, how many couples do you know who get divorced, who when they're at the divorce court, when they're talking about the divorce court, and they ask them, like, hey, why do you want to divorce your spouse? Do they say, I want to divorce my spouse because she's living in blatant sin, and I'm hoping that this will wake her up so we can one day become reconciled. I'm just really, really concerned about her and her spiritual walk, and I love her so much that I want her to be benefited. And in fact, I'm going to prove it by remaining celibate and continuing to support her in whatever way I can. Do you really hear that? Or do you hear, why do you want to divorce her? Because she sucks. She's the worst wife ever. Of course I want to be divorced from her. She's annoying. You know, that's usually what you hear. In the Bible, there's a whole different reasoning, and that's a whole different topic I'm not going to get into today. But there's a whole different reasoning for a Christian to get divorced than for a non-believer. All things that a Christian does is in love. That is our heart and motivation. It is to love people. We are never to do anything that is out of selfish ambition. It's Philippians 2. Do nothing out of vain conceit or selfish ambition. Everything is to be out of love. Even discipline or divorce or separation. It's all to be for the benefit of others. So, we have a little bit of time. Do you guys have any questions about the stuff that I went over? How do you use it? So, if you are single, the things that you should be praying for and about is to ask God, God, show me ways that I can serve you in your kingdom in my singleness. So, whatever way that God has for you, to just really press into that. Every single person here has a ministry. Every single person here has a ministry. You have families. You have friends. You have coworkers and people you go to school with who you talk to every single day. And God is telling you, if you're single, here's how you serve me. You really, really invest in those people and you attempt to benefit them in the kingdom. All right, so you give more and more of your time to that. And that also means, and like I said, there's a way. Investing in non-believers is important. It's definitely important to evangelize. But it's also important to invest in the lives of people who believe too. Something interesting about working at a church, it's almost like the Wizard of Oz when the veil goes away and you see the man behind the thing. When I went to church, I always thought that everybody was perfect. Then I started working in a church and I realized everybody is screwed up. Like every single person who goes to church is massively screwed up. And which shouldn't surprise me because Jesus said that his church is for the sick, not the healthy. So that makes sense. You know, we're all sick. We're all messed up. So for those of you guys who are, again, if you're single, I would encourage you to try to get more involved with the church body. Doesn't mean you have to serve here, but it means try to get more involved in each other's lives. Try to do that. Try to get more involved with other believers, other people who believe in God, and to really learn how to love and serve them selflessly. That's how you utilize your single gift. And you could also utilize as a single person, like I said, when you're married, you got to worry about your family. You got to worry about paying bills. You got to worry about taking care of them and buying them food. That's your primary ministry and service. As a single person, you don't have to worry about any of that. As a single person, I once did a summer where I gave every single paycheck to the church just because I felt called. Not because God told me to or I had to. It was a joyful thing for me to do. I gave every paycheck to the church, and it was really fun. If I was married, I couldn't do that. So there are things that you can do as a single person with your finances and your time that you can't do as a married person. And so I would encourage you guys to really be in prayer and ask God how to do that. And God will answer that. Like, God, show me how to use my singleness for your glory. And he'll show you. Again, the wrong way to look at your singleness is that it's a bummer. Like, I just want to get out of this thing. The right way is to look at it as a positive thing. And even if you guys are called to be single for life, there were many people in the Bible who were called to be single for life. Jeremiah the prophet, Daniel, the Apostle Paul, all great men that God used very powerfully, and they never got married. And even some women in the Bible never got married. So it is cool to think how God can use single people. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Do you guys have any other questions about singleness, marriage, sexuality? All right, if you guys do have any questions that you're just a little too shy to ask in front of other people, you can come up to me afterwards. Me or Mike or Tom, and ask us about these things. But let's pray, and then you guys will have a couple minutes. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word, how it teaches and instructs us. I pray that we would learn more and more how to abide in your love, how to be loving people and not lustful people, Lord, how to understand that we are complete in you, God, that we don't need anything or anyone else. And please show us, God, more and more how to serve you and how to serve your body. In your name, amen.